Welcome to the ADHD Alchemy Podcast, where women with ADHD finally feel seen, understood, and unapologetically themselves. If you have ever felt like you're too much and not enough all at the same time, you're in the right place because that's the alchemy, learning how both come together to make something priceless. I'm Jessica Covington, holistic ADHD coach and fellow fancy brain, and I'm really glad you're here. Let's get into it. Welcome to ADHD Alchemy. Guess what? It's more than a podcast. It's also my signature coaching program at Fitology. I built it for bright, sensitive women who are tired of feeling scattered and chaotic and ready to feel calm, clear, and fully in their strength. Inside the program, whether it's group or private, you'll finally clear out that brain fog and move forward quickly. Together, we will quiet the relentless inner critic, break old patterns of procrastination and self-sabotage, and begin redefining ADHD on your own terms. This is where your too much becomes your magic and where real lasting change begins on day one. If that speaks to you, find more at fitology.com. That link, of course, will be in the show notes. Today's guest is Kate Rope, an award-winning freelance journalist who just published her latest book called Strong as a Girl. It's the guide that every parent needs for raising an elementary age girl in the midst of modern chaos. Her website, katerope.com, holds a treasure trove of articles about parenting and more. She's been on staff at Life Magazine, The Bangkok Post, and more. She doesn't stop at writing, though. She also produces and edits, and somehow she finds time to be a fierce advocate for science and mental health. At home here in Atlanta, Kate is also a wife, a mom of teens, and an engaged community member known for jumping into any situation where she can help others. So, Kate, I'm so excited you're here. Thank you.
Thanks. I'm thrilled to be here. I'm excited.
Awesome. Your story is so relatable for a lot of people. You are not entirely sure that you have ADHD, but you're definitely feeling the brain fog of midlife and noticing some challenges that weren't there before. Can you say a little bit more about those?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I saw a friend I hadn't seen in a long time recently, and she said to me within like the first 5 minutes of our conversation, "Where are you on your neurodivergence journey?" And I loved that question because I definitely am somewhere on that journey. And I thought, what a contemporary, awesome, what a way to ask it that's like open and non-judgmental. What a contemporary way to talk with, to connect with somebody about whether this is, you know, something in their life that's bubbling up or has been there. So I meant to text her this morning to say, what was it about me that made you ask that question? But I would say I am definitely aware that I'm neurodivergent in the sense of sensory issues. You know, I have misophonia. I was the kid who had to have my clothes a certain way and couldn't wear certain kinds of sweaters. I'm incredibly emotionally aware. You know, I can read the room in a second, which I always thought was just, I'm an empath, but now I'm understanding that to be actually a skill associated that, again, that puts me somewhere on a neurodivergent spectrum that I have sort of this spidey sense. And then ADHD, you know, more specifically, I have no idea. You know, I don't recall struggles in school that felt relatable to the way I understand ADHD now. But you know, girls are good at masking, as I know, and I interviewed neurodivergent girls for my most recent book and talked to experts. And you know, there's underdiagnoses in girls because they know exactly what the world expects of them, and so they're able to deliver it enough in a way that they may fly under the radar. So you know, and also I was growing up in the 80s, right? Like, so there wasn't that awareness. So I don't know. You know, did I have challenges in school that might have been related to neurodivergence? It's definitely possible. I certainly feel in midlife, and I am in perimenopause, so I know that's a big factor. And it did, brain fog did come on very strong. And so I definitely feel there's a pretty big hormonal element to that, and it improved significantly when I went on a hormone replacement therapy. So, but I do feel a decline in my ability. You know, I used to be just a mad multitasker, and I used to be on top of everything, and I didn't get things wrong, and I got to appointments on time, and I remembered everyone's names, and I just was never. It just always felt kind of like it, like I operated at this level, and now, my God, I would say I'm 60% down from that, maybe. And I don't know if that's neurodivergence, you know, rising up, if it's brain fog, if it's perimenopause, if it's our modern life and how, you know, you get information from text and from DMs and from emails, and you get interrupted in the middle of things, and you're working at home. And so you're working, but then a kid asks a question. You know, I don't, it's like the experiment is so polluted. It's like not a pure randomized controlled experience, not controlled at all. So I don't know. I don't know. But I'm open to learning, and I definitely think I could benefit from skills that, you know, address issues related to ADHD, that whether that's what's behind this or not, or whether it's part of what's behind this.
Yeah, you bring up a good point that I say a lot to people when I'm talking about my work, which is that the stuff I do and the stuff that executive function coaches might do, it's really good for every brain. It doesn't have to be just an ADHD brain that uses these strategies and techniques and so on. It's good for anybody. And the key in my work, the key is the body-mind connection. And I think in any work, the key is finding what works for you and doing those kind of individual experiments and trial and error and so on. So have you been able to find any techniques or strategies that work for you to clear out the brain fog when you really need to?
Well, when my book came out in October, I had a lot of podcast interviews, and I was very nervous about those. So I would really just, I wouldn't try to do anything else the morning of the interview. I would give myself time to sit down and just center myself. And because I think so much of it can be just distract, I'm just distracted. I'm just, you know, and so focusing, just kind of like being like, this is the only thing I'm doing right now. So that's helpful. You know, I was telling you before we started recording that my therapist has been on this kick related to my mental health to get me to just pick like two things I'm focusing on for 2 weeks, because I tend to have a lot of projects and I'm sort of reinventing my career, and so I've got a lot of ideas, and then I feel so overwhelmed by all of them that I end up having very unproductive days. So she's getting me to, you know, decide, okay, until February 1, these are the two things I have to do, and then I have to build in rest, which is, you know, for her, the mental health aspect. So there's those things. Trying to not be on my phone when I'm with my family, you know, for multiple reasons, but certainly it helps with this. I found that I'm so used to distracting myself that I started printing out crosswords, so I can do a crossword. So it gives it scratches the itch of like wanting to look down at your phone, but it's not as distracting, and you can carry on a conversation and you can take breaks easily. Let's see, what else do I do? I mean, I have a pretty good to-do list. I think those are my big things. And I would say, sort of the mind-body connection, I had a very active meditation practice. I took an 8-week course called mindfulness-based stress reduction a few years ago for stress reduction. And that was the most attentive I've been in, like just my 20 minutes a day of meditation, the repercussions I would be in conversations, and I would remember, I would pay attention to what the person was saying, and then I'd have a response because I was paying attention, and I'd remember what I was planning to say, and I'd remember names much better. So I'm having a hard time getting back to that practice right now, but that definitely was a really good support.
Absolutely. That's great. So let's shift gears a little bit and talk about your book, your latest work. For Strong as a Girl, you talked with groups of neurodivergent girls and various people around them. What did that show you?
Well, what it showed me in a nutshell is that when we engage with this topic in an open, educated way and we support girls or anyone, I'm sure this applies to anyone, but in my case, it was girls, with an open lens to what their experience actually is and what the supports are that meet that experience, it can be a really empowering, lovely, like they felt to me in some ways ahead of the game than my other focus groups. I had Zoom focus groups with girls of all from ages like 13 to 22, from different backgrounds and identities and lived experiences and abilities. And they were so emotionally aware. They had all come from families that recognized their neurodivergence, that had gotten them good diagnoses and were working on giving them the support they needed. And they had a range of sort of they had a range of how much their ADHD or autism, in the case of a few of them, affected their day-to-day lives. But they all were so aware of it and were able to articulate it, and they were able to articulate their needs to one another in these focus groups that I thought, well, this is the power, right? This is the power of recognizing where someone's strengths and challenges lie and just meeting them there and giving them the support to move forward the way they want to with that information and that support. So an example I'll give is that there was one participant, their name was Goldie, and they were a big interrupter. They were very big personality, lots of information, lots like bringing in, check out this that I have in my room, and I love this, and I loved that energy. But there were a lot of interruptions. I didn't say anything. I was just rolling with it. But eventually they said, you know what? I can't stop interrupting. So I'm going to put myself on mute so that I can continue to interrupt, but I won't be interrupting. And I was like, what? H are you 50? Like, like I'm in perimenopause coming to some understandings of myself that are that aware and also vulnerable, right? Like I can't stop interrupting. So here's what I'm gonna do to support myself. It's a boundary for me, it's a benefit for you. So that kind of, to me, the biggest thing I took away was what is possible and what kind of growth is available when people are recognized. And this applies to the whole book, but in the case specifically with neurodivergence, when it's recognized where what inputs are good for you, what inputs are challenging, and how to maximize the good and minimize the difficult. And I just it that it was like a 3-hour focus group. Most of them were about an hour. And they interrupted each other sometimes and say like, or when someone was not interrupting, when someone would start to talk after someone else had said something, they'd say like, yeah, I understand what you're saying. That's not exactly what my experience is. It's more like this for me, and it was just the most emotionally mature focus group. And then after, and then they just got super excited about their interests and how they were all the different. And then about hour and a half in, it was just them talking and sharing their stuffies and their costumes and their games and whatever, their art. And then they were exchanging phone numbers and, had made new friends.
Wow. It sounds amazing to watch all that in action and to see that develop real time. It really it points out a lot of the strengths that I think we often see in ADHD specifically, but all kinds of neurodivergence. Chief among those is, number one, the ability to be self-aware, and number two, to forge connections over that. So many people, I think, with ADHD have an amazingly deep sense of empathy and social awareness that makes it really easy for them to make friends as long as there's nothing in the way. But I digress. Going back to your point, and something you said before we hit record was about how parents and caregivers can relate to kids who maybe wire differently? What did the focus group show you about how adults can relate to kids who think in a different way?
Some of it was very specific, and some of it was kind of revelatory to my own parenting. One participant, Jillian, said, "You cannot say to me, do X, Y, Z, you know, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. I need you to tell me to do A, and then I can get A done. But if you tell me, if you take it to G or even C, I'm overwhelmed." And it made me think about conversations with my daughter, who's 13, who doesn't have a diagnosis, but like me, is a very emotionally tuned in person and just reads the room and just, that's kind of overwhelming as I just think about it myself. Like, think about the overwhelm of walking into a room and knowing everything, you know, oh my God, that person feels left out. No one's talking to her at the party. I should probably talk to her. You know, is my friend that I brought with me having a good time? You know, whatever. So she's similar to me in that way. And I would say to her, it's really simple. Do the dishwasher, go upstairs, you know, get your clothes on, take a shower, get your clothes on. And she's just like, stop. It's too, you're just overwhelming me. You're shouting at me. And I wasn't shouting. I might be talking sort of like that, like kind of firm. And so that just, I changed on a dime when Jillian articulated it that way. Cause I thought, oh, you know, I just thought she doesn't want me telling her what to do. She's being stubborn or whatever. And now I realize maybe no, that's exactly how she processes information. And the way I'm asking her to process it is not appropriate to her. So there were some specific things like that. There was a lot of talk about respecting interests. And, you know, I know talking with the experts that interests, and you know, I feel funny saying this to you because you're in this world and you have this expertise, but, where, you know, neurotypical kids or whatever might, you know, kids who sort of fit in this mainstream definition or whatever might, you know, connect based on age or their ballet class or their church group or their grade. Interests are really the glue for a lot of neurodivergent girls, people, but in this case, talking about girls, and that's a really powerful way to build connection for them. And so to be open to that. And then some of the caregivers I talked to said, and then that's kind of, I've like, one of the most beautiful things about being a parent to neurodivergent kids is I've been exposed to new communities and new experiences and just being open to those, which is something I talk about in the book in general, raising girls. You know, it's so easy for us to say, well, I really liked soccer and she seems like she's kind of good at soccer. Yay, maybe she's going to play soccer, you know? And then we get kind of down a road where we haven't really stopped to say, do you like playing soccer? You know, so really stepping back and assessing their interests and then honoring them. And I think that's just amped up a little bit more for someone who's neurodivergent for whom that may be a primary focus. Other things, you know, there was conversations around bullying and around finding support from one of the girls didn't feel that she had really a peer support network and that, and she felt very other. Whereas some of the other girls had found that in different ways, whether through an interest group or some other, you know, place that their caregivers or parents had taken them that connected them with girls who shared similar experiences. And I could definitely see the benefits and I could see what the one person who felt she didn't have that, the impact it had on her. I could see that. A couple kind of really specific things from the experts. So one of them was really being open with your children and with a child who is getting a diagnosis or going through the process and letting them relate to the experience the way they relate to the experience. I remember, I think it was Debbie Reber of Tilt Parenting said, you know, sometimes parents want to say your ADHD is your superpower. They kind of want to, you know, they want to soften the blow of something they worry might have negative stigma. And so they try to spin it positive. But if that's not how the child relates to it, if the child is experiencing it as a challenge or something they're not comfortable with yet, or then they're not being validated for their own experience with it. And then that feels like another layer. Like, I don't like my ADHD, but I should because my mom says it's my superpower. So that was something very specific about respecting the way they relate to it and knowing that will evolve over time, you know? I mean, you know, especially with like upper elementary, early middle school, so much of the way you relate to something can be influenced by peers. And so, you know, if you're able to sort of create this strong conversation in your home about this wonderful person they are and the way their minds work, and, you know, they're probably going to feel some kind of way based on peer, you know, influence, but they'll come out the other side with that solid foundation you built, you know? So, that was one thing. And then, another thing that Amanda Morin, who wrote, Neurodiversity Affirming Schools, she's co-author of Neurodiversity Affirming Schools with Emily Kirchner. And she talked about something in the disability community that's called the quote unquote crip trope, which is the idea that if you are in a wheelchair, you have to be really nice or you have to be really good at math. I also talked with Emily Ladau, who's a disability rights activist, who felt that way growing up, that she had to somehow make up for being in a wheelchair. And similarly, the same thing can happen with neurodivergence. And actually, one of the girls talked about that, like, don't say because I have ADHD and I really like art that it's like, oh, she's super creative. She has a super imagination. That's part of it. You know, just I'm a kid who likes art, you know. So I think not like everybody should just be fully accepted for who they are. You're wonderful with whatever you bring into this world, and you don't have to make up for it or have something special to make yourself more acceptable, or you're good enough as you are. You don't need to add on things. So those were some of the specific things that that the experts and I talked about. Yeah.
Absolutely. What a wealth of knowledge.
Yeah.
So let's talk about what's feeling really important for you right now in this season of life. What do you want more of or less of or clarity around?
So, as I mentioned, I'm sort of pivoting. Journalism as a field is shrinking, and so I'm thinking about, and that's been a big part of my career besides writing books, is, you know, being a journalist. How am I making money, and how am I finding fulfillment? And in the process, I'm experimenting. I'm working on my first novel. I'm actually, and this is since
Wow.
I agreed to come on this podcast, I'm actually thinking of starting my own podcast. So I'm kind, and then I've got editing work that pays the bills, and then I've got, should I be looking for a job because I got a kid in college, and you know, so I feel torn. I feel pulled in a lot of directions, and I feel like the end result is not really doing well at any of them or even moving the needle, and then feeling like I should be. You know, I'm, you know, going on Facebook or Instagram or TikTok and seeing my fellow writers doing all the things and thinking like I should be doing that and I'm not, but I don't really want to. And then I think figuring out how I separate myself a little bit from this information economy, which has been my bread and butter, but I feel like it's so crowded and we have so many voices telling us how to do things, you know, check out my this, check out my that, that I'm really considering. I mean, if I didn't have kids, I would move to a cabin in the woods. I would really want to just sensory deprivation tank, you know, just read and write by myself in nature. So how do I find that kind of experience? How do I find a piece of that amid, I've got a kid still in middle school. I've got a college student, so I can't retire now. You know, I've got to be paying for college for the next 8 years. So, and how do I step back a little bit from all the inputs for my kids as well? How do I support them in doing that too? I just feel like there's just so many inputs and so many directions that information is coming at us. How do I quiet my brain in the middle of that. So I would say those are my biggest challenges, sort of quieting my brain and being okay stepping back from this very busy marketplace of ideas and thoughts and words. And then also, how do I find my way forward? And when not unrelated, like related, how do I find my way forward to a career that feels good, in a way that feels focused?
Yeah. Those are all such, there were a lot of points in there, and they were all so important. What really struck a chord for me was the idea of having so many options and so many roles and responsibilities, and being spread so thin that you feel like you're not able to move ahead or make progress or be really good at necessarily any of them. That is, I have felt that myself at times, and it's really, really heavy. And I think it's really common, you know. It's a beautiful time to be alive because there are so many options and there is so much information, and it can be overwhelming. So to your point, how does one find the clarity and the focus in that? I have an idea or two, but I'm curious if you have found anything on your path that's helping you get that kind of focus.
Wouldn't what I said earlier about my therapist making me, pick
Yeah.
two things to focus on for 2 weeks. That's new, and it seems to be helping. What I really want to do, but am having a hard time actually doing, is really just exiting social media for a while, which is a main networking space for me and a way for me to share my work. So it's hard to step back from it, but I would really like to just read books and right, I would like to figure out a few ways to make money, or one way to make money, but that sounds a little like pie in the sky. But some solid ways to make money that, like, I love editing because it's just me and the words of someone else, and I'm just molding them into something bigger than they are on the page as they are. And then being able to just read books and have my brain be stimulated by these ideas, and then be creative in a measured way that doesn't feel like I'm trying to catch up, I'm trying to market myself, I'm trying to get attention. No, I'm just doing good work by myself that then will hopefully be fruitful and see the light of day.
Yeah, 100%. And I wonder if, in your case specifically, I wonder if finding pockets of time to do those things might be useful. Pockets of time where you could just spend time editing or just spend time reading, either for n your own enjoyment, no purpose at all, or as a way of making progress towards something else, maybe reading what is later to be edited. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, read, I think that's a great idea. And I think it's probably a matter of like thinking about a structure that could support that and then some discipline within it. But yeah, I mean, that is one thing about being a writer and an author is reading is almost always about your work. And thrillers are my just absolutely love thrillers. That's my escapism, but now I'm writing a thriller. So when I'm reading thrillers, I'm still kind of working, but it's very enjoyable work. If all I had to do was read thrillers and then sit down to write my book and research and sit down to write my book, I'd be a happy camper. It's just no one has said they'll pay me for that. Unfortunately, with fiction, you have to write the whole thing and then get them to pay you instead of nonfiction where you can pitch it. So I can't really just focus on that. But that sounds beautiful.
Yeah,
So how would
maybe one
you
day.
go about how would you go about creating those pockets of time? Nitty gritty.
I think it's a great question. It depends. It could be done in a number of ways, depending on the person's schedule and needs. It's possible that for some folks, it might work to say, all right, Monday is going to be my reading day, and then Tuesday will be my administrative day where I take care of either office chores or maybe things around the house or errands outside the house. Wednesday is when I write or edit and so on. My sense is that not a lot of people have entire days to devote to a particular task at a time. So maybe it has to be smaller than that. Maybe it has to be an hour at a time or two. One thing I recommend often to folks, this is kind of in the context of time management. So when folks are really working hard to increase their punctuality, when they've been consistently chronically late because of all kinds of ADHD things, including the idea that we can get 10 things done in the 2 minutes before we have to leave the house. When they're working on that and they find themselves getting to someplace a little early, my suggestion often is to take a plan B. Take something you can engage in if you end up there early and occupy your mind, because boredom for ADHD is literally painful. We cannot stand being bored. So, with all that backstory said, maybe the plan B gives you pockets of time. If you arrive someplace 15 minutes early, that's when you can read a thriller, for instance. I think outdoor time is really, well, I don't just think it. I know it because of the research that shows us outdoor time is super important, really beneficial for cognitive power, for working memory, for creativity, and so on. So one of my recommendations to somebody who's trying to work this out might be, if you can find the time, and often you must because there are things you have to do, take that outside if you can, even if it's just on your front stoop. If you have a backyard with a mass expanse of trees, even better, but getting outdoors is almost always going to benefit whatever it is that you're trying to work on. I don't know. I could probably talk for days, hours about ideas.
It's interesting because I did land on that recently with so my my task until February 1, according to my therapist, is editing, which is pays the bills, and job hunting. And so I have found it feels better to do them on different days. Now, it's not to say that's all I do that day. Like, I'm sprinkling in the errands and the administrative stuff. But to the extent that I'm sitting and working, I'm just doing one or the other. And that feels really good. That feels, I don't know what it is about it. It just feels cleaner, maybe. It feels less like, well, when am I going to finish this and start that? It's like, and it feels, it gives me some comfort, like from the stress. You're going to get good editing done today. And then Wednesday or whatever, you're going to get, you're going to apply to three jobs. And that's going to feel really good that you've put that, you've done that. You've put that out in the universe. It's no longer your problem. Unless luckily they respond and then it is. But so that really resonates with me for sure. 'Cause I was trying to do it. I was trying to do chunks in my day earlier, like at the end of last year, and that just was not working for me. Especially because once I'm in a zone, if I'm really writing, I'm really writing, and I don't want to break that, or job applications tend to take way longer than you think they're going to. And so then it's like 2 p.m. and oh, I was supposed to start editing at 1, but I've just accomplished a ton and I'm tired. And so then I feel guilty. Oh, I'm not editing. Well, if it's like, well, tomorrow's editing and you did the thing you needed to do today, allow yourself some jigsaw puzzle time or whatever, which is one of my relaxation things I do.
Yeah, it allows the part of your brain that's always on constant watch, constant alert for what time is it? What do I need to be doing next? It allows that part to relax a little bit, clears out a little bit of that cognitive clutter, and lets you really engage with the work. That makes perfect sense. Well, Kate, It's time for us to wrap up, but thank you again so much for being here. It's been a really great and enlightening conversation. I know stories like yours are going to help women know they're not alone in this feeling of being not diagnosed, maybe not yet diagnosed, but definitely feeling some executive function
Burnout.
challenges. And it feels especially, burnout for sure, overwhelm. And it feels especially important to highlight times when women may not know what their brain style is. She just knows things have changed and something's not quite the way I want it to be. Now, for people who want to reach out, and every parent should, how can they find you?
So my book, my most recent book is Strong as a Girl, Your Guide to Raising girls who know, stand up for, and take care of themselves. And you can find this anywhere books are sold. And then if you're a new mom or pregnant or know somebody who's in the beginning of a bringing another person into their life journey, this book, Strong as a Mother, How to Stay Healthy, Happy, and Most Importantly, Sane from Pregnancy to Parenthood is also available anywhere books are sold. And then if you want to read more about me, my website is katerope.com, and I'm most active on Instagram at Kate Rope Writer.
Excellent. And all of those will be in the show notes. Kate, thanks again for your time. It's really been wonderful.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
Here's today's lab kit, three ideas from this episode that you can start using in your life today. Experiment number one. This is the idea of having only two things that Kate and I discussed. So here's what you'll do. For the next 5 days, choose only two forward-moving priorities. These are not errands, they're not maintenance, they're not things you know you should do, but they're things that actually make a difference. They move the needle, they create a tangible result. For each day, you can work on one, you can work on both, or you can work on neither one of them. Whichever you choose, there is no judgment. It's just data we're collecting here. We're not chalking up wins or failures, just data. The catch is you can't add a third activity. Keep it to two. If you think of something else that needs to be done, fine. Go ahead and write it down. Capture it somewhere, whether it's your phone or a notepad or something else. Capture the new ideas, but don't act on them yet. Keep it to two priorities. At the end of these days, reflect and ask yourself, did it feel calming or constraining to have fewer options? And if you found yourself avoiding the two priority items, what did you do instead and what was going on? This works because it directly targets the action gap, not by pushing more effort, but instead by removing decision chaos. Experiment number two, single track days. In this experiment, you'll pick 2 days this week or next week and assign each one a track. So, in Kate's instance, she might have chosen a day that was for creating. It could be writing, thinking, building, imagining. Another day might have been for administration and response kinds of things, stuff like emails, logistics, life tasks, that kind of stuff. Whatever track you choose during that day, when you notice the urge to switch, when you are working on creating, but you have the urge to switch to something administrative, don't switch. That's the important part. And then write it down. Write down what was happening, what you wanted to switch to, what you were feeling in your body, what rationale your brain came up with to make sense of wanting to switch. You are not aiming for perfection here. You're just noticing how often your brain tries to run off in a direction that you have not set for it. At the end of those days, those 2 days, reflect on whether your brain settled more deeply into one mode or another. And if it didn't, where did the resistance show up? What was happening outside yourself and inside yourself? So often we think that what we need is better discipline. Oh, I just need to stick to this, or I just need better focus. But sometimes what's actually true is we need less task switching because there's a cognitive cost associated with that. Experiment number three, this is the backup plan practice. So here's how you do it. For the next few outings, whether it's going to pick up your kids at school or heading to a doctor's appointment or going to the grocery store, do two things. Number one, aim to arrive 10 to 15 minutes early on purpose. Number two, take with you some kind of backup activity, a book, a crossword puzzle, notes for something that you want to think about and sort out. It can be anything. Preferably pleasurable, but it doesn't have to be. It could be something productive. I might take something, some work notes that I've been working on. If I'm developing a new course, I might take those notes and continue adding to them. If you don't arrive early, if you end up getting there on time, it's still a win because you've gotten there on time, right? And that can be rare for those of us with fancy brains. If you do make it 10 to 15 minutes early, then you have your backup activity with you and you're not killing time, but instead reclaiming time that usually leaks away. It can be restorative time where you gain some energy back for yourself, or it could be productive time. Then at the end of those days, reflect on whether that felt really grounding, whether it was nice to have that little tiny pocket of found time to use for yourself, or whether it was irritating. And notice whether you had less urgency or rushing overall by having that intention just to show up 10 or 15 minutes early. This experiment will gently help you rewire your anxiety over time and your tolerance for boredom, as well as the reflex to just pick up your phone when you're bored and scroll through. This is building self-trust in tiny, quiet moments. And that's where the shift can actually happen. I'd love for you to try at least one of these experiments and let me know how it goes. I am so excited about these that I'm actually going to create a download that you will find the link to in the show notes. And it will guide you through these experiments in a clear and repeatable way. Please let me know how it goes. And please share this with somebody who really needs to hear it. Thanks for listening to the ADHD Alchemy podcast. If you're nodding along and thinking, oh yeah, that's me, then please subscribe and share this episode with another woman who gets it. Your reviews help more women discover they're not failing. They're just wired differently. And that is a good thing, despite the challenges. Plus, I want to hear your story. Apply to be a guest at myadhdalchemy.com and join my free community at fitology.com/community. Those links will be in the show notes. Together, we can rewrite the ADHD shame story into one of strength. I'll see you next time.